This final panel was titled Transformation. The idea was that having gone through the other panels, that we would have some sense of, or at least have the wherewithal to start thinking about where to go. And Paula particularly did not like the word translation, which I think other people have said. And so this is essentially a where do we go from here kind of meeting. Terry and Kurt and Paula and Mike have already spoken, so my suggestion is that we hear some comments from those who have not spoken already, and then we'll have a panel discussion. So perhaps, Leon, do you want to start with this? Leon Lederman from the... where do you want to be from today?
Oh, I really don't know.
Okay.
Where I am. No, I know where I am.
Let's call him the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy today, which is the relevance for this.
I was told to bring a bomb. So I thought, what could be a bomb? So I have a bomb.
Just some incendiary remarks.
My bomb is a statement that any effort to transform, that's a good word, education in the U.S., I believe will have to cope with the perception that education is totally a local responsibility, because we meet that all the time. So that's the bomb, is I think we have to develop a national strategy, national, not federal, and I will always use the word national rather than federal, although there's a question of how far you can go that way. Now, I came to this by being on a national commission. I was co-chaired this with my partner at the AAAS, Shirley Malcolm. And what we did was to sit down and read all the reports we could find on education, reform, transform, going back to somewhere before A Nation at Risk and reading these things. And I believe that all of these reports are filed in Washington in some dark basement saying, reports, file here, don't implement. Or effectively, it's the shelf of reports which you can read. I mean, we read them all, well, largely, and I found they were all eloquent, well-written, informed. I mean, we didn't find any dumb ones in those reports, unless somebody filtered them for us. Oh, you know, the Glenn Commission and the Rudman Commission, all reports, but reports, commissions, panels, workshops, roundtables. We read them, and they were right. They had they know what's wrong. They know about teachers and what to do. They had suggestions, good suggestions, as to how to fix these things. They were beautiful reports. Often they are, unfortunately, should reports. What's a should report? A should report is the governor should do the following, and the mayor should do the following, and so on and so on. Everybody has a task in these. But these were good reports. So the question is, why is there this failure to implement? And I don't want to list the history of these things, but I was inspired by what happened with Sputnik, because we recently celebrated 50th anniversary of Sputnik, and remember Sputnik was a threat. And today, all over, you see, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we had a Sputnik? Because somehow that was an urge to implement that was fantastically successful. We implemented all kinds of things. NASA was created, DARPA was created, the Defense Education Act, funny thing, but was done, and Congress voted funds for things that were unheard of, you know, without that implement of Sputnik. Well, actually, I believe, and this is sort of gets to the justification for the bomb, I do believe that we do have a Sputnik. It's not called Sputnik, it's called global climate change. I happen to be a believer, a lot of friends in that particular sphere of combination of sciences, from oceanography to atmospheric chemistry, these climatologists and so on. And I fear for my grandchildren. I think this is going to be a real threat. And I don't think it's a threat that can be alleviated by changing the light bulbs. I think it's a good thing to do. You should change the light bulbs. And all the things we're working on, many of them have promised to help, and they will help. But fundamentally, my own impression from a large number of talks I've listened to and friends I've talked to tells me that none of these will do what we have to do, which is to have a change of lifestyle. I mean, you go outside and you see all the cars out there, and you can't do that no matter what you put in. You stuff all the cornhole hulks into the gas. It doesn't work. Some of it works. A lot of it will work. We're making progress in many things. But a change of lifestyle. And why do I say that now? Because I think that has a huge implication for education. I really do believe it. I've done a lot of things in education, and over the, 20 years, I've been almost full-time on it. I know all about graduate students. I've taught undergraduates a lot. I was am involved in the high school in Illinois. Some of you may know about the Illinois Math Science Academy, an incredible place. And if you ever feel discouraged and you want to be encouraged and you want your optimism to be restored, you can come to IMSA and we won't charge. Just talk to the kids, and many of you probably have similar experiences with bright, articulate, wonderful children, free to pick their own, choose their own educational future at this incredible school, which is, if you don't know it, it's a state-supported public residential high school for gifted kids in Illinois. And it's just terrific. Anyway, I also spent a lot of time in Chicago, famous Chicago school system. I think it was Secretary of Education in the Reagan administration that said Chicago is the worst school system in the nation. And when he said that, the people in Detroit were very upset. But you get the idea. So I worked in the Chicago schools, and what we picked on to be able to help was primary teachers. So we learned how to teach primary school teachers to teach science. And unfortunately, we talked about teacher training. Primary school teachers worldwide, because I then applied this stuff in Europe. I was at an international commission on science education, and eventually a lot of the things we learned how to do in Chicago were copied in France with something called Manalapat. But this is primary school, K through 5 or so, and where we concentrate. And the teachers that come out of the schools here, but also it's international, are almost untrained in math and science. Maybe they take a course or so. Stop, it says. Okay. Yeah. Okay, what I'm getting to is the following, and I'll say it very quickly. To me now, if all of these activities I've been doing and I'm still doing, the most important thing I think we can do in education, if I had to pick one thing for some reason, I would say it's public science literacy. We've got to get the public on board. I call it also the Oprah Winfrey fantasy, because she doesn't answer my telephone calls. I call and I call. But we need that kind of charisma, that kind of leadership to get the public involved in this. All the things you're doing, this is a wonderful session. I've enjoyed it a lot. And I keep saying, how are we going to implement these things? How are we going to get these in all the schools? And I think that, and it was touched on in the last session, that states have to talk to each other. We've got to get a national consensus. And therefore, we need a kind of institution, and we proposed that in our report in Washington, doesn't exist now, like Sputnik created institutions which didn't exist. I think this present need for public understanding of science is so important that we need an institution that looks into that and looks into the implementation of all the wonderful things you're doing here. These are just terrific things, a terrific session. But we do need a big change, I think, if we're going to change education in this country. Thank you.
So, David, would you like to address next? David Lightfoot from the National Science Foundation.
So I head up the Directorate of Social, Behavioral, and Economic Sciences at the National Science Foundation. And that includes work on cognition. And the biggest thing that we do, and one of the biggest things that the foundation does, is to run a fairly new program in the Science of Learning Centers, and we are being hosted by one of those centers here. And I want to talk about, sort of two big ideas behind this program. I'm going to talk for most of the time about one. The other one is kind of self-evident, given where we are. And then Susang Lim, who actually runs the program, will talk at a little more detail. So I want to put the this enterprise in context. So it's that stage of the day. We need something. We need something interesting. So within the human sciences, as in all sciences. One of the things that drives us is we try to move mysteries into the realm of science. Okay? So in the area of human behavior, there are mysteries. Okay? So we actually know a fair bit about love and anger, a little bit about consciousness, but we don't have a sort of scientific understanding, and that they sort of exist in a kind of Dionysian realm of poets, novelists, and philosophers. On the other hand, there are certain areas that we've been able to kick up stairs into the sunshine of Apollo, and notably work on language, vision, and economic decision making. And in these areas, we've been able to apply what Steven Weinberg calls the Galilean style. So we work with idealizations, abstractions, mathematical models. And then there's a bunch of areas that are sort of on their way up. They're not quite there yet, but there's a prospect of work on, for example, numerical cognition, spatial cognition, of moving in that direction. And where we've succeeded, so in the areas particularly of work on language and vision, it's resulted from a sort of a complexity science approach where one understands complexity through the interaction of simple systems that meet certain basic requirements. And this cuts, the work on complexity science cuts across all of the sciences. And at the moment at the National Science Foundation, our major initiative is in complexity science, through the big new initiative in the otherwise miserable 08 budget, which is called Cyber-Enabled Discovery and Innovation. Within the human sciences, there are many examples. The human sciences are sort of permeated by complexity problems. They fall into a number of classes. One of them is sort of tipping points, where there are major, big structural shifts that happen in dramatic fashion. The collapse of economic markets is one that we're going through at the moment. Okay? Then there's a class of phenomena of sort of emergent phenomena, we call it, where faculties emerge in us ontogenetically in the course of the development of an individual, and also phylogenetically at the level of the evolution of the species, where things emerge that go beyond the conditioning factors. And then there are many complexity issues that have direct consequences for policy. Okay, again, where one can think of major political shifts. Most of us lived through a remarkable period in human history, the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, where a whole bunch of totalitarian regimes just disappeared, essentially peacefully. This is a slide that's been up a number of times. So one example of an emergent phenomena is learning. Okay? So learning emerges, and often what happens in learning, that in most of the interesting cases, is that the learning goes beyond the conditioning factor. So it's an emergent phenomena. So the brain learns, and we've heard a lot about that today. I think we've heard a lot about the brain. I think we would be better off to think in terms of the mind-brain. Okay, the mind is what the brain does. And we're never going to achieve a very deep understanding of the brain by investigating the sort of physiological properties that current brain imaging facilities afford. We're going to have to look at that along with the faculties that the brain is responsible for. Darwin's word was that the brain secretes consciousness, language, vision, these various cognitive faculties. And what this leads to is, you know, it seems to me, the biggest question in science. Okay? Physicists are concerned about dark energy and dark matter. Okay? Well, there's a lot of dark matter between our ears. Right? And what I mean by that, there's a number of things I could mean by that, but what I actually mean by that is that what's at stake is we need an understanding of matter, in this case, brain matter, which actually yields the mental functions, that yields consciousness. So that's a kind of dark matter, and it's a very fundamental question which engages not only psychologists and linguists, but also physicists. Okay? Physicists are in the matter business, right? And brain matter is just one example of that. So within the areas where we've been successful in vision and language, what's emerged is this kind of complex systems approach, where we see built into the organism certain options which then get triggered through the fine-tuning of experience. Okay? So we've got a pretty good understanding at this point of the way in which the visual system works. So built into us is a potential for edge detectors and angle detectors. And these are options that are available, and they get triggered and set, in the case of humans, in the first few days of life. And recent work over the last 15 years or so in linguistics, takes a similar approach to the acquisition of languages. That there are options built into us. And then depending on where the child is being raised, whether it's in an English-speaking environment or a Japanese-speaking environment, the parameter settings emerge, and you have an interaction then, so this is where the complex systems approach comes in, between information which is built into the organism, so somehow represented in the genetic material, and information which is derived from the world outside. So under that approach, science declared, the way Science magazine can, that the breakthrough of the year last year was variation in the human genetic material. Okay? We're not all the same. This has come up a number of times today. And this yields, this sort of offers new kinds of understanding of learning. It gives us new ways of thinking about autism and schizophrenia and so on. So the big idea, or one of the big ideas behind the science of learning centers, is to explore the shift to complexity. This is all new. If you go back not very long, about a generation, work in cognition and psychology more generally was driven by the behaviorist paradigm, certainly in this country where it was extremely dominant, not quite as dominant in other countries, but here dominant. And there the notion was that essentially, you know, the brain is cream cheese, and experience can write on the cream cheese, right? But there's nothing very interesting beyond sort of very general dispositions that are built into the biology. I think a major event in the downfall of that approach, and the downfall was a little bit like the fall of the Soviet Union. It took place rather rapidly. I think a crucial element in that was our understanding of the immune system. So this was work done in the 1950s and 1960s. The view of the immune system was that our immune systems developed in response to experience. But then the work that was done in the 50s and 60s, which led to a Nobel Prize in the mid-80s, was more of a selective system. So there are certain options that are built into the organism, that are built into the sort of possibilities for the immune system, which then gets fine-tuned, so in much the way that we now understand vision and language. Niels Kajerna got the Nobel Prize for this, and his Nobel Prize address is one of the most frequently cited Nobel Prize addresses anywhere, where he explores the consequences of this shift from what he called instructional theories, that's to say, in our world, so these behaviorist psychological theories, towards selective theories. So that's a big idea that is being explored by all of the science of learning centers. At this point, we have six, okay, so three of them now in their fourth year, three younger ones like TDLC now in their second year, all of them looking at learning from different perspectives. And the other major goal of the science of learning centers, which I will comment on very briefly because it doesn't require any further comment, is events like today. It's to try to bridge this chasm that we've talked about so often today between the cognitive and learning sciences on the one hand and educational theory and practice on the other. It's going to take events like this for this to happen. This event, with due respect, is not going to change the world. It's going to take many events like this. We've seen something of the depth of the chasm today, but the chasm has to be bridged. And the science of learning centers represent, to my mind, a major and promising attempt to do that. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And as advertised, Su Xiang Lim will now complete the story from the NSF.
So the complexities of learning, some of the complexities that David alluded to, pose extraordinary challenges. These are the sorts of challenges that require expertise from multiple disciplines and research agendas that are often beyond, these are the challenges that require expertise from multiple disciplines and research agendas that are often beyond the resources that are available to individual investigators. To meet these challenges, the National Science Foundation established the Science of Learning Centers program in 2003. This program provides large-scale, long-term funding for the creation of centers that will give the kind of intellectual, organizational, and infrastructural support for long-term advancement of learning. The goals of the program are to make transformative advances in the science of learning through integrative research and to connect the knowledge and discovery to challenges that will benefit society. And these challenges include other scientific challenges, educational challenges, technological challenges, and workforce challenges. The program construes learning very broadly. We're interested in learning in animals, humans, and machines. And so the program also covers a variety of topics, ranging all the way from cell molecular basis of learning. We're interested in processes and systems, so we're looking at cognitive, social, cultural influences on learning, and we're interested in artificial intelligence and robotics. For the purposes of today's discussion, I will speak to only what the Science of Learning Centers are doing with respect to meeting the educational challenge of connecting the science of learning to educating. To make connections, especially when there's a huge gap in between, we build bridges. And to build a bridge, we have to have appropriate supports. Even though we are a fairly young program, TDLC and a number of the other centers are making important contributions to bridging the gap between evidence-based knowledge about learning for its use in educational practice and policy. The Science of Learning Centers are providing sort of bridge supports in terms of infrastructure as well as intellectual support in the knowledge and in the generation of new knowledge, and also people, the training of people that can cross the bridge. That can, and we talked a lot about today about developing the capacity of individuals who can work to bring the two sides together. So there isn't time for me to go to tell you about our individual centers, but what I would like to do is to talk about some key features of these centers, and these are features that are brought about by NSF's significant investment in these centers, and which we think are going to be extremely important to the discussion, to the issues that we discussed today. The Science of Learning Centers are research centers. The large-scale long-term funding that is provided to these centers allows our investigators to carry out big, bold ideas that are beyond the capabilities of individual investigators. And these resources allow the centers to bring in all kinds of expertise that is necessary for attacking these issues. This, in addition to critical mass, the center framework also allows for long-term planning and conversions of efforts to the common purpose. They also allow for longitudinal studies that are important for assessment of trajectory of learning, for example, over the lifespan. Now, all centers have partners because of the goal of our program is to also take the knowledge and to put it to good use. So there are very long, stable partnerships that are being established between the researchers and sort of the stakeholder communities. And in the case of the Education Challenge, our center members have a lot of connections with school systems, museums, and others involved in education. Now, these kinds of long-term stable relationships are going to be important for some of the things that we talked about today, the need for two-way sort of iterative, continuing types of interactions. And some of these things that come to mind in thinking about what the products of these kinds of relations might be is that there might be a better alignment of research agendas with that of the needs of the education community. It also brings teacher input and engagement into the activity that is likely to result in new theories and new ways of practice. And it is also a source of professional development that I heard some of you mention that would be also important. So there will be a generation of new ideas on both sides, both in the terms of researchers and the educators. So from hearing partners and researchers talk about their experiences in doing this, they talk about new insights and new ways of looking at things just from the experience of working together. So in turn, we're bringing together a breed of researchers that are somehow transforming themselves in their way that they will approach this problem. But there is also another aspect that I want to mention, and that is the work at the centers are being conducted by students and postdocs, the next generation. So these are people that are going to start out thinking about these issues in a more holistic and comprehensive way. And this is what we're truly excited about, too. This is very much part of what we're trying to accomplish with the centers. And then very quickly, some of the other benefits are that the infrastructure, the framework, the funding provides the kind of infrastructure that is needed, both in terms of data collection analysis, transfer and dissemination of knowledge. And also, there isn't time to talk about this, but the centers are also engaged in a significant amount of evaluative processes for the activities that are ongoing at the center, and this will be important in terms of quality control issues that are mentioned today. Importantly, I want to say that each of the Science of Learning Center is a national resource for everyone. And so please, I encourage you to know more about our centers, and I have brought some pamphlets about the centers that you can take a look at. So I spoke about what is at one center. We have six centers in our portfolio. So very briefly, the opportunities and the advantages, benefits, just multiply sixfold. This allows for another level of collaboration, synergy, and synthesis. And we think of this as a network of centers. The SLC network of centers allows then for sort of the timely exchanges of information and another level of coordination of research agendas that is not easily available otherwise. So the centers, just the six centers, involves 30 academic institutions, about 60 non-academic institutions, and these include school systems, museums, etc., and more than 550 participants. So this is truly a web that is in the making, a human web that is in the making. The time is up, so I just want to bring this information will be available, presumably online, and the links to the centers are there. And these are sort of the geographical distributions of the six centers. I've only indicated the major partner institutions affiliated with the centers. So in summary, the Science of Learning Centers provide resources for transformative advances in science of learning, and they are test beds for translating evidence-based knowledge about learning to educational practice. And they build capacity for a new breed of researchers and teachers. And we think that that program is actually a very big experiment. There will be successes and there will be failures, but I think the issues that confront us are so important that we dare not try. So, thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Su Xiang. Finally, the patient Jim Nelson, executive director of the AVID Center and former superintendent of Richardson Independent School District in Texas, a number of governmental positions in the school boards in Texas, and until 1999 when he became Texas Commissioner for Education. So, Jim Nelson, thank you.
Thank you. This is a lot of pressure. I'm the last thing standing between you getting to ask a few questions and having a drink. So I understand that brevity would be valued. But I would say that after this has been incredible today, and to sit at this table with these individuals, in particular Dr. Lederman, is pretty intimidating. I agree with one of the earlier speakers. When I saw where I fit into this, I thought there'd been a typo and that was supposed to be somewhere else. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's really, truly an honor. I would also say that if I were only given 5 minutes to live, I would hope that it would be judged the same way the 5 minutes has here today. Because I would have a long and healthy life. But I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. And so after saying that, I will probably violate the rule too, and the young lady will be waving her signs at me over there. But I really will try to be brief because I know you want to ask some questions of these incredible people up here. We at Avid, I'll touch on Avid very briefly. Avid was begun by Mary Catherine Swanson, who some of you here in San Diego undoubtedly know, in 1980 in one classroom at Claremont High School when she believed that a group of students that were being bused there from South County, if given the right kind of support, could be successful in rigorous classes. I don't think anybody else believed it. In fact, she laughs now and says that her goal was to make a program that was principal proof that the principal or any other administrator couldn't screw up. And so she spent the next, and she was incredibly successful in terms of helping those young people go on to great successes and many, many thousands after that. We are now in 45 states, 3,500 schools, 16 foreign countries because we're in all the Department of Defense schools, and there's about 300,000 kids that are directly impacted by Avid right now and many more that are indirectly. What she would now tell you, I think, is that she's found that the leadership at the building is incredibly important, not only for Avid to be successful, but for the school to be successful. So we're spending a lot of time now focusing on the whole leadership issue to the point of creating an academy for leaders. One of the things I found as superintendent in a very good school district, but a very diverse school district in the Dallas area, was that how difficult it was to get and keep really strong leaders in challenging schools. When what would happen when I would get a really, really good one, somebody at the central office would leave, and so I would promote that person and create a gap that, you know, it's like shooting yourself in the foot. And I did it over and over again. But so it's incredibly important that we find ways to make sure that that pipeline is continually refilling itself. One of the things that was kind of touched on today that as we meet these challenges, and they are daunting. You know, when you look at urban school districts now in particular, they are massive bureaucracies. We're talking about millions and millions of children, oftentimes in aging facilities. You have a lot of turnover. Huge bureaucracies. It's really, really difficult to take the concepts that we've talked about in this room today and really have them apply at high levels in classroom after classroom after classroom. Yes, we have many, many creative and extremely talented teachers, but we don't have enough of them to fill all of those classrooms to get the kind of results we're talking about. So we really have to think a lot about, I think, the model. We're seeing a lot of things now, you know, whether it's the kind of academy you talked about, whether it's the high-tech highs that we talked about today, the KIPP Academy concept. I mean, there's all kinds of things out there that we need to be looking at to try to make sure that we maximize the potential we do have in our workforce. You know, we kind of have an industrial model that's been around now for a couple of hundred years. She's waving the sign. That means I'm on point one.
Well, you could ignore it like everybody else did.
Yeah.
So,
I only have 38 points. No, I really only. Actually, I started with seven. I started with seven, and to be polite, I cut it back to four. But I do think, you know, and I, you're the people that can really help us figure out better ways to do school. There have to be ways, and I know you mentioned cost earlier, in terms of having teams of teachers work with lots of kids. There's got to be ways, and I realize we have accountability issues and assessment issues, and, you know, I was commissioner of the state where accountability came from, so I appreciate what you're talking about. But I will also tell you, before we had good assessments, we didn't know how poorly black kids and Hispanic kids were doing. So it's easy now to be very critical of assessment, but we ignored them for a long, long time. Now we know, but we have to figure out better ways to teach them, and better ways also that we don't have these mills where we are spending all of our time teaching to the test. I could not agree more with that. We've got to figure out better ways. But the reason those things were created was because we weren't doing a very good job of teaching those children. And we were ignoring to a considerable degree how they were performing. Teacher preparation. I chaired the agency in Texas for a while that oversaw both the accreditation of the universities and or the programs and also the credentialing. And I, when I got into that, I really didn't know a lot about it. And you may wonder, why did you chair it? Because I got asked to. But there were some very, very competent people involved, and I did learn a great deal. And I think I came into it somewhat critical of teacher preparation programs, which it's easy to do. But I came out of it realizing that the considerable effort that was going into the process, and in most instances they were doing a pretty good job. But I don't think we should expect them to graduate people prepared to deal with all of the issues that are out there to be dealt with. That, you know, those, you know, there's more PhDs per square inch in this room probably than anywhere in San Diego, and none of you got your bachelor's degree and were ready to do what you do now. Nor should we expect our teacher graduates to do the same thing. So what we have to do in the post-service training programs is make sure that we give them the kind of skills so that they can succeed and can have the kind of support and the collaborative efforts that go into that so that they can continue to grow. You know, there's been a lot of talk today about pedagogy and content or versus content. I think the consensus should be they're both important. And let me give you two quick anecdotes. A good friend of mine up in L.A. that's with the county office told this story the other day about the teacher candidates that she's been working with who come out of some of the best institutions in Southern California. They are full of zeal about how they are going to change the world. They're going to go into L.A. Unified, and they are going to fix these problems. And after about 6 months, they're losing a lot of them because they go in there and they find, you know, these kids aren't near as interested in this as I am. Well, you know, that's a pedagogy problem. You know, they don't know how to manage a class. They don't know how to do a lot of things that go into that. So those are things that, you know, we clearly have to deal with. But on the other hand, you have content issues. In Richardson, we found that our math scores were really good in the elementary level. In fact, they were better than just about every district in the area except the ones that didn't have diversity. But we found when they went into middle school, they really dropped. The achievement gap just went from here to here. And it didn't make any sense because these African-American and Hispanic kids seemed to be doing fine at fifth and sixth grade, but they really did poorly once we got them into algebra or any kind of higher mathematics. And so one of the benefits I had, she's waving her sign, one of the benefits I had was Texas Instruments was our largest taxpayer, and they were very engaged in this whole process. And so they came to us, or we sat down together and figured out a way for them to help support us as we tried to find some of those solutions. And one of the things they did is they paid for a survey that every one of our fourth through eighth grade teachers took, and we called it a survey. It was really an assessment, but it is what you call it. So we called it a survey. And the reason they were willing to do it, number one, it was anonymous, and number two, TI gave them a brand new calculator. And what we found, to none of our surprise, that especially the teachers teaching fourth, fifth, and sixth graders hardly had math skills much further than the sixth graders did. And so, you know, you can talk all you want to about how important pedagogy is, but if they don't know math, they're going to have a pretty hard time teaching sixth graders. So we developed professional development programs around the fact that what their needs were, that TI helped us with a lot of retired engineers and so on and so forth, and it really almost immediately paid dividends, almost immediately. Just one quick point, and then I'll stop. I'll just go to three points. One of the things that we're seeing, that we see at Avid, but I certainly saw in my work in Texas, and it's critically important in California and Florida and a number of other really big states, is this whole issue of how do we find ways to do a better job with second language learners. They are flooding into schools, and it's not all Spanish, although a lot of it is. My district in the Dallas area had 93 languages, 35,000 kids, 93 languages. They came from all over the world. I went to a little elementary school one day. They had 20 kids from Somalia showed up that week. You know, Catholic Charities or somebody was housing them somewhere in the district, and they just showed up. Well, you can imagine how lost those kids were. We had great teachers, and they did some incredible things, but they're not magicians. And so we really have to figure out better ways to work with those children. One of the things we're doing, a couple of pilots up in one in L.A. and one in Orange County, trying to kind of a pre-AVID process so that we can move from trying to just remediate those kids to accelerate. Many of them are very, very bright kids, but they just have a language barrier that we have to figure out ways to work through. So one of the things science can do for us is help us figure out a way to do that. I'll stop.
Thank you. So one of the things that we used to say a lot about the Science Network is to quote Carl Sagan, where he said it's suicidal to have a society that's dependent on science and technology in which hardly anybody knows anything about science and technology. That was the literacy problem, but that was sort of a down message as well. So we shifted to the other Carl Sagan quote, which is science is like a candle in the dark. So at meetings like this, we did one last year, we do a regular meeting called Beyond Belief, which started being about science and religion, shifted into morality and all sorts of things. But the conversation at one point gets a little abstract. And so Jeff Hawkins, who invented the Palm Pilot, got up and made a very, very brief talk and said, what are you going to do? I mean, what's the practical thing that you're going to do? So I've been asking people since then, what's their candle in the dark? What are you going to do? What's the candle in the dark? So let's just run along the table and see what happens. Mike, what would you do?
Well, I first felt pretty depressed about being here today listening to these talks because I felt once again, as I often do at this kind of meeting, as that I walked into the swamp again. And then I felt uplifted in myself that actually I looked and I reflected, well, at least, you know, I've tried with other scientists and other people to actually carry this science into the world against a lot of resistance, against a lot of negativism, against a lot of naysayers and skeptics and so forth. And I think that one of the things I say is that there's tremendous value in just doing something, you know. No kid is getting better without improving the strategies in which we engage them in schools. And, you know, we know that it does not necessarily take a very great change in the efficiency with which a brain takes in information and records it, and that sets it up for using it, manipulating it, to make a hell of a difference in the life of a kid. And we know that there are enormous differences across the school-age population that apply to that. So, for example, if I just look at the number of minutes that a child spends reading outside of school, you know, a kid at the top of the distribution in the middle of their school life will read about 4 million words, if they're in the top 10%, a year. The kid on the bottom of the distributions reads none. A kid at the 30th percentile reads about 100,000 words. And that kid is in the environment in which they're competing with the kid that's reading 4 million words a year. If I could improve them in their reading, in their competence, in their neurological operations, so that they could read 10 minutes a day, they would improve almost 700-fold. Now that's pretty, sevenfold. That's a pretty damn big difference, right? And that's a long way towards catching up. So one of the things I'm really excited about from the point of trying to carry brain plasticity-based, intensive brain plasticity-based training into schools is that it demonstrably actually helps children catch up. It changes the trajectory. So when you actually look in a school in which these intensive programs are applied, children move across the distribution. So you can have a kid that sits maybe at, the 25th percentile, and on the statistical average, they might do something for 20 or 30 or 40 hours. And then a year, two and a half years later, they've crossed the normal median. They're on a catching up slope. And really, that's something that technology, that applying these brain science-based strategies can give us with increasing power. Now, what we do is primitive. It's just a first approximation. It's just sort of stage one of doing the right thing. mean, these are evolving. That's really one of the wonderful things about this, in a sense, is that through an iterative progression, we have all of these tremendous assets of information technology. Every time a kid is operating an exercise, we can measure how they're performing, we can evaluate the effectiveness of it, and we can rapidly make progress to make these better and better and better and better. I say it's not just about pedagogy and content. It's also about giving children better brains so that however they're approached, how they're delivered information, and whatever the content, they're recording it, they're storing it, and they're manipulating with more and more and more power. And I think science into schools will bring that for us with technology. Technology is a critical aspect.
Okay, I mean, this is not limited to this panel, by the way. Feel free to jump in, but does anybody else want to say something about this?
No.
Okay. Light a candle.
Yes. One of the things we really need is infrastructure that supports the connection between research and schools. We don't have much of that, and we desperately need ideas for how to build it, how to make it work. One such idea, for example, some of us are working on, is research schools, the Deweyan idea of lab schools, but really developed so that there are real collaborations between researchers and practitioners in schools that are helping shape research questions. And shape educational practice. I would like, as the editor of this new journal, Mind, Brain, and Education, that you've heard about, I would like to invite any of you that have ideas about infrastructure that could accomplish some of this to write me about it. Hopefully, we could develop a way of communicating about these ideas in the journal. Ideas about infrastructure that will help create better connections between research and educational practice.
Okay, David Bolton, you want to say something?
You know, I've been in this space for about 20 years, really concerned about the same issues that we've been talking about today. And I've come to believe that there is this movement going on, starting to move more towards a medicine model, But one of the things that goes on for medicine that doesn't go on for education, that's kind of one of its organizing principles, is above all else, do no harm. And that one of the monsters missing in this conversation is how much of our learning is being disabled by our learning. And that rather than having all of our learning science and research connected to the educational objective, that the Sputnik Project and the NCF Project and the kind of national thing that I would most advocate is the creation of the kind of National Institute for the Study and Prevention of Acquired Learning Disabilities. Somebody needs to be looking out for that side, kind of independent of all the agenda to push what we think people should be learning. And let that not be subordinate to the entire educational mechanism, but a parallel informing loop to all of this.
Thanks. David Lightfoot, anything on this?
So your question is very broad, right? What's the magic bullet? So, but we all work in different domains, and so.
And your answer could be in SLCs, but I don't know.
Leon points out that education is local, right? So it's at the state and county level. But one question that I think is worth asking is, in that context, what is the role of the federal government? So there are two significant players there. One is the National Science Foundation, but much bigger is the Department of Education. And I don't think there's been a clear articulation of the appropriate role of the foundation via the Department of Education. Now, these are small players in the grand scheme of things. In terms of our expenditures on education, put the National Science Foundation together with the Department of Education, it's small potatoes. But those small potatoes could still be used strategically. And I think this is something that needs to be thought through. So we're doing that at the foundation, in part through this program in Science of Learning Centers,
And so, you know, the bullet that I was talking about is, I think there's a lot of work to be done given the new understanding that we have of cognition and learning, a much more biologically based approach. And that has ramifications across the board. The centers are exploring that, and this is something which should be encouraged, and it's a long-term enterprise.
Terry?
So I have some practical advice. So we were asked to come up with something that could help, and this is going to help you remember what you've learned here today. And it's something that only recently have we come to appreciate how important something that we spend 8 hours a day doing without really understanding why we do it, and that's sleep. Over the last several years, many studies now have confirmed that if you have sleep deprivation, you shortchange your ability to retain information. And unfortunately, Americans have been burning the candle on both ends, and especially, to my shock, students in high school are not getting enough sleep. And we now know that, from many studies, that memory consolidation, your ability to put together facts that otherwise are disconnected, a lot of that is happening during sleep, as well as renewal. And so what I would offer as my suggestion to this audience is to go home this evening and have a good sleep.
Eric, I should say that's from one of the people who has the least sleep I know, but go ahead.
If I can just say quickly, the new issue of Mind, Brain, and Education is all about day-night rhythms and learning in students.
Circadian rhythms.
Yeah. I want to add one real quick thing, Roger, and then so we can finish up, and that is that anytime a neuroscientist can give educators anything close to a take-home that's practical, it's very, very appreciated. Years ago at a conference, Dr. Sanowski, in one of his talks, I said to him, so what would you suggest to educators? And he said something, well, maybe after a lecture, let people discuss it and then take a walk and a break for a while. And, you know, it sounds real simplistic, but that rarely even happens. You know, that's a pretty important bit of practical advice, and that if it's appropriate, educators appreciate things like that, that are grounded and that won't do any harm, so they realize that, you know, there's something we can learn from it.
Brenda is actually waving a form at me just to remind you that she would like you to fill in those survey things and leave them in a box. So I promised I would say that. There's somebody at the back there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I can't see you. I'm blinded.
I dropped out of the high school system mostly because I saw that I lived in a very rich town, kind of like La Jolla, and I saw that the audience in that neighborhood, they may have had all the degrees and the money, but they were miserable human beings for the most part. So I saw that the school system wasn't really going to be preparing me for a wonderful life. It may prepare me for college and a job, but I realized at an early age that there was more to life than money and a job and a piece of paper so I didn't know what I was going to head out for, but I was headed out so that I could learn to have a magnificent life and succeed in all 10 areas. Along the way, I've been homeless, I've had numerous challenges, and now I work with major leaders in our community and teach them basic life skills. And I'm just, first of all, I'm extremely grateful to be here with so many people that care and love our humanity, that you're willing to be open to upgrade to new ways. It just seems to me that after 100 years, we're finally going to the students and saying, hey, what if we base a system based on you rather than based on what Henry Ford decided was going to produce factory workers, with a one lunch, which creates obesity in our country, with lack of exercise. I mean, our system, it seems as though we've built this bicycle that we expected to operate like a car, and now we want it to fly. And I'm thinking, is it even the model we want to be working with? And does it need to be completely overhauled? Einstein was known to quote, basically, you can't fix the problem from the mindset that created the problem. And we have brilliant teachers here, but we're still living, and you don't realize that the scientists may come up with great projects, but they don't have a full scope, and they're not completely thinking in system technology, which Descartes and Newton kind of got us involved in, all this separate, that we go out and exercise. Why can't we add a math problem into our exercise process, and that we mix it all together rather than it's all this chunking down and separating, and that's not life. And we separate our children from reality. I could go on, but that's if anyone wants to respond, there's plenty more where that came from.
Well, there we are, and that's all solved then, isn't it? So there we go. Paula, yes.
All right. So we've spent the day talking about a lot of research and knowledge from research and how it could connect with educational systems and our need to have much more of a dialogue, two or three or four-way street, about different perspectives. But once we do have ideas that we have aspirations for translating for the good of our children in the future and the good of our society in the future, there's a big gap about how to scale those up, or even a knowledge about what's the right approach to take to scale those up. I said something a little bit about this later, earlier. And if we really have the desire to scale up in such a way that we can actually gain more and more and more knowledge and data from the systems and that we're interested in, let's say from the schools, let's say we have some ideas, they work in the lab at a minimal level, we can either spend years and years and years and years of refining them in the lab, or we can go straight out into the schools and try to begin to refine them there with partnership, with real partnership and feedback. The problem that arises in doing that, since we have actually done that over a period of time, is that it falls between the cracks just to a great extent for funding. Because as soon as you get to the point that you really need to scale up, then you need the kind of resources that come from business generally. There's other ways to do it, but that's one way, if we look at our society, in which everything else that I know of has scaled up. And once you start doing that, then it begins to fall through the cracks in terms of what kind of research you can do around it. So I think we have this gap in, we have a mission to scale up, we have a mission to do research that's going to be relevant, but at the point at which you really try to do it in such a way that you're developing programs and products and you're getting feedback from schools and making them better and getting feedback from lots of brains and making them better, then it falls into a completely different realm. So I think we need a process, we need much more discussion, much more honest and open discussion about how that's going to work and how one can continue to do research and basic research while at the same time going ahead and getting on with the job of just trying something out. I mean, we can wait forever, but kids are still really suffering. So I think that's really the challenge that we all have. How far along does it need to be? And my feeling is it will never be complete. So when do we get a chance to just try it?
Just please note on page 10 of your programs is a list of names of people who are Science Network staff or TDLC staff who helped put all this together. I'd just like to thank them on the record for having us here. Question still there?
Yes, my name is Linnea, and I'm a survivor of the Detroit public school system.
And congratulations.
I'd like to mention another gentleman who's a survivor of the Detroit public school system, Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. Is anyone here familiar with the Center for Nonviolent Communication and their work in the school systems with their nonviolent communication? A lot of people call it giraffe language. Could I see a show of hands? Is anybody familiar with his work in Israel and in the United States and other countries around the world? Well, I'd like to encourage everyone to go home that's here today and get on the web and look up Center for Nonviolent Communication, because having survived the riots and my upbringing in Detroit, I know that one of the most important things is that these children live and teach and learn in nonviolence. And that's a big problem around the world right now, as we all know. And his work and the work of the volunteers and trainers with the Center for Nonviolent Communication is, in my opinion, one of the key things to children learning and becoming adults that are going to make a contribution in our society. If people can get at feelings and needs and learn those words in school, then we all have a future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Terry has a thought, and let me also go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I'd like to just make a brief comment on the T in TDLC. There are many out there who believe that space is the final frontier. You've been watching too many reruns. Time is the final frontier. It's a non-renewable resource. You can't make more of it. You can be a billionaire, and you can't use that to buy more time. And the theme of our center, Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, was chosen because we really think that how the brain manages time really needs to be examined on its own merits rather than just in passing. And it's been mentioned over and over again. In fact, Kurt's comment, I think, is really telling that our whole lives unfold with the circadian clock that governs our internal temperature, our hormones. They're all cycling with this 24-hour time scale, and it has an enormous impact on your brain, what time it is in the morning that you're getting up, what time you're thinking about things, what times you go to school. And for some reason, we somehow have lost track. We've gotten disconnected from the sun. We've artificially put ourselves in an environment where we're really not anymore respecting the way that our bodies, not just our brain, behaves. So I'd like to just leave us with the thought that time really is going to become more and more important as we get more deeper into the brain and also into problems with education.
Mm. All right, it's about time. Those of you who saw yesterday's New York Times probably saw that wonderful photograph of a town in northern Norway which was awaiting its first sunrise since October. Yes.
I just wanted to thank you for keeping us rolling today.
Oh, thank you.
And we owe you a round of applause.
One little thing. We'll be back in here tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and I'll be doing a conversation with Leon Lederman for those of you who are able to come back for the second day. I sense a little synaptic fatigue, but Gary wants to say something.
Yeah, I just want to thank everybody for coming, and you all have contributed to this, and I really appreciate it. Since I do have the final word, I just want to say that I think I was somewhat misinterpreted. You do need to know about motivation. You have to put gas in the car. You have to direct the students' attention. You have to steer. When things are confusing, you have to turn on the wipers. But you don't need to know how a spark plug works, or you don't need to know how the Hodgkin-Huxley equation describes neurons in order to teach. So
I disagree with that.
Okay. Anyway, I just want to leave you with the thought that time is really just God's way of keeping everything from happening at once. And so let's go have a drink and think about that.
Thank you.